the Simon Evans Goes to Market. Not the first time I've been likened to a little piggy. It's usually the eyes. Mother could be very cruel. Now, I'd like to expand on that little piggy, but first, I should warn you that in the programme you're about to hear, I intend to get to grips with the world of financial markets, investments, profit and greed. But before you reach for your radio's off switch with an urgency hitherto reserved for Moneybox Live, let me explain why I'm doing this. Let's look at that title. When we're young, This Little Piggy Goes to Market involves nothing more sinister than unwanted toe contact from a slightly odd uncle. We like to picture that little piggy cheerfully heading off to market in a yellow waistcoat with a neatly knotted little scarf around his neck. It's only some years later that we realise that the pig was in fact as deluded as we were. Far from being the trader about to enjoy the cut and thrust of a day's bidding, he was the goods, and the only reason that he was still alive as he headed off to market was so that his flesh didn't spoil in transit. How many of us are like that little piggy, gamely trotting off to work every morning, perky as you like, blithely ignoring the fact that we have somehow become confused with the livestock, that we are being jostled and crowded with other equally deluded individuals on our way to the abattoir? Does it have to be like that? Do we have to play the role of the little piggy when it comes to the markets? Can we at least buy a share in the slaughter? Here to help me find out is presenter of Radio 4's More or Less, a Financial Times columnist, the thinking woman's Robert Peston. Tim Harford. You are a man of enormous intellectual breadth and experience in this field. Can I ask you, first of all, my joke was quite funny, wasn't it?
Well, Simon, I want you to feel that this is a safe space, so I'm going to say yes, very funny.
Thank you very much. Also, and we'll be coming back to Tim for more and lengthier enlightened insights later, I have invited Editor-in-Chief of Money Week, Merin Somerset Webb, to join us. Now, she can't be with us in person. She lives in Edinburgh, and seeing as I can't afford her advice in real life, I thought I'd ask her on the show and get it for free, or at least with your licence fee. I began by asking Merin a very simple, fundamental question. What is an investment? Not as simple as it sounds. For example, when a glossy magazine urges you to invest in a really good pair of shoes, is that really investing, or is that just spending your money in a more boring way than usual? Merin, is that investing?
A nonsense use of the word. What defines an actual investment, something that you want as an investment, is that it will provide you with a regular return, but also protect the capital value of your original stake.
And in that respect, no pair of shoes can ever possibly qualify, however robust.
Unless that pair of shoes is going to give you a new pair of shoelaces every year, it's not an investment.
Thank you, Merin. I'd always thought as much, and we'll be able to quote you the next time that particular row kicks off at home. In this first week, we're looking at one of the most fundamental, perhaps the most ancient of all investments.
This land is your land, and this land is my land.
This week, we are going to be looking at land, presumably the very first thing that was ever bought and sold, apart, of course, from sexual favours. And, of course, those VHS tapes you still see in charity shops. Tim, is this a fact, or is this, am I deluded? Is land the earliest kind of traded item?
Well, I doubt it. I think it was more likely to be something like obsidian, which is a volcanic, glassy thing, good for making knives and slicing things up. If you're going to swap, say, meat for obsidian, we swap, you walk off with the obsidian, I walk off with the meat, fine, no problem. If you actually want to sell me land, how is it that you're going to say that you own this land? How are you going to lay... You can't walk off with it. So if you've got an army, then you can defend the land, but then if you had an army, you wouldn't need to buy and sell it.
So what you're saying is you need essentially a legal infrastructure to protect your rights to the land before you can start trading in it.
Absolutely. It becomes really, really complicated. The obsidian's an awful lot simpler.
OK. Well, we'll try and fit in an episode on obsidian towards the end of the series. Now, For most people, an investment in land starts with buying their own home. And in this, they're not short of advice. Most of daytime television, for a start, is devoted to the ups and downs of buying your own home. Probably most famously, Channel 4's location, location, location. A mantra widely used to determine a good investment, and hence why the programme was such a hit, while BBC 4 show Chimneys, Chimneys, Chimneys was sadly axed after just one series. Which brings us on to the other great TV show on the subject, Property Ladder, wherein Sarah Beeny spent an hour trying to advise odious would-be property developers how to make money, and we spent an hour hoping to God they lost everything and ended up on the streets. The trouble, of course, was that Sarah Beeny's sage advice was in fact largely academic. During those boom years, you could have bought a house, boarded up the windows and spent the next 3 years in the pub and still reaped massive profits. You could scrawl, "I will kill again," on the lounge wall in red paint and still be beating them off with the proverbially fouled stick. Making money from property has always been more about cheap credit and upward trajectories than magnolia paint. It doesn't matter if you install a cheap power shower, a solid marble wet room, or a bucket on a tripod with some holes punched into the bottom with a nail. The market, like an unlicensed minicab driver, takes you whichever way it wants, regardless of what you do. And doesn't this just sum up our lack of engagement with the market? We trundle around IKEA on the lookout for the perfect patterned cushion while ignoring the macroeconomic trends that are really in charge. Property Ladder also promulgated another myth, namely that of the ladder itself, and the idea that getting your foot on the first rung is what owning property is all about. Because when you first hear about it, you imagine this so-called property ladder to be a nice, sturdy, stable ladder, the kind you might find propped up against a venerable old garden wall. In fact, once you're on this property ladder, you realise that it's often much more like one of those rope ladders that dangle out of a Sea King rescue helicopter in gale force winds. And that even if you do manage to grab hold of it, the only way to move up is to keep leaping from this ladder onto other ladders dangling from other helicopters and all piloted by gibbons. Don't lose heart. Land has always been a good investment in the long run. As Mark Twain said, or possibly somebody else off the internet, land is the thing to buy because folks will always want it and they ain't making it anymore. Twain's observation remains broadly true, and besides, for every new island created in Canary Wharf, another hotel slides off a clifftop in Scarborough, so it evens out in the end. The British have always instinctively understood the appeal of land, specifically of having a little place to call your own. In contrast, the French famously don't own their own homes, but instead rent apartments, mainly so that they can have affairs without subsequently losing them in the divorce. The difference between buying and renting, as any sexually exhausted Frenchman will tell you while lying supine on an adulterously tousled bed, is a philosophical distinction as much as anything. Renting recognises the human need to move on from time to time, to be free of ties, and indeed to lie on one's back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, smoking gitane, ignoring the wet patch and staring at a ceiling fan. Ownership, meanwhile, recognises the human need to be trapped, to lie on one's back at 2 in the morning, unable to ignore the wet patch in the ceiling as you calculate the cost of getting a new roof and hence how many years away your planned long weekend in Bruges is now. This is known as security. So those are your options. But even the French, who don't want to own their own home, still feel this primeval attachment to it, which is why they cling to the notion that they're any good at farming. Unaware that it's only the protectionist legislation of the common agricultural policy that allows them to compete with countries served by better weather and harder working people. So, we all want land. The English want their pebble-dash semis, the French their so-called farms, the Americans, of course, yearn for the frontier, and the Russians are currently snapping up as much as they can get their hands on with scant regard for proper conveyancing or the exchange of contracts. Tim, this is a popular myth that the British are peculiarly obsessed with owning their own homes. Does it have a basis in reality?
It has a basis in reality. We used to own our homes more than Europeans, and now we don't anymore. And I think the reason is not because we don't want to, but because we can't afford to. We're not building anymore. So over the last 10 years or so, British home ownership has fallen to the European average. of about two-thirds of people live in their own homes.
I guess the fact that we did get obsessed with home ownership drove up the value of the real estate we live on, which you could argue is a good thing for the nation as a whole.
It's not necessarily a good thing. If you look at the countries in Europe that have very high rates of home ownership, they include Romania, Latvia. If you look at the countries that have very low rates, they include the Swiss, the Germans. They're doing all right. So maybe they've figured something out.
This is a very English thing in itself. It's like the English idea that only we have what you could really call a sense of humour, and that Americans don't get irony, despite the fact that they made The Simpsons and we made Birds of a Feather. But there we are. Everyone, then, wants a bit of land. We can agree on that. And as an investment, land feels safe. You might invest in art. It could be reappraised as derivative and worthless. Fine wine can become corked, or more likely uncorked and drunk. If you own a home, you have at least got bricks and mortar. You've got roots. It is true. Buying land, buying property, it's not totally safe. It goes up as well as down, and they have to put that on the end of every advertisement. But the funny thing is, nearly everything else we buy is worth about 20% less than you pay for it by the time you get it home. Nobody ever says, caution, the value of your LED 52-inch television could go down as well as up, because the value of your TV is only ever going to go down, even if they do cancel BBC Three. Perhaps the main reason why property is a tempting proposition for the investor is down to something called leverage. And what is leverage? Let's ask Merrin Somerset Webb.
Can you explain leverage in as simple terms as possible?
Borrowing money.
Great, thank you, Merrin. And can I ask you, Tim, to explain leverage in slightly less simple terms? What is it specifically about borrowing money to buy a house that means it's called leverage, whereas if you borrow a tenner to go down to the pub, that word very rarely gets used?
So if you imagine buying a house, it's a £200,000 house. A year later, imagine the house has gone up by 10%. Well, you've made 10% on your investment of £200,000. If the house has gone down 10%, you've lost 10% on your investment. Now imagine you've got 20 grand, you put that down as a deposit, you've borrowed the rest from the bank. Now imagine the house goes up in value 10%. It's gone up in value £20,000, you put £20,000 into it, so you've doubled your money. And if the house falls in value 10%, you've lost all your money. So you've got this 10% move in the value of the house. If you buy it with a mortgage, with leverage, the impact on your investment is dramatically increased.
It is, I mean, it is like a physical lever then, a lever being a screwdriver, isn't it? A lever which you place on a fulcrum, say the rim of a paint tin, and by pushing down and going through a long arc at the long end, the short end goes a short distance but can move a heavier. That's basically what you're doing, right?
Yes.
And the impact that has on the market itself, does it apply elsewhere? Why do we not get leverage to buy a car? Why do we not get leverage to buy a TV?
Well, you do get leverage to buy a car. You borrow money to buy a car, but you don't expect the car to go up in price, so you don't really think of it like that. There are other parts of the economy that use leverage, not always in a good way. So, for instance, the banks. And I don't know if you've noticed, Simon, but there was a bit of a problem with the banks a few years back. And one of the key problems was that banks were borrowing a lot of money and lending out a lot of money. They were very, very highly leveraged, to the extent that if a bank lost even 2 or 3% on its investments, it could be completely wiped out because of leverage.
So the difference between leverage and debt is essentially the prospect that what you've used to buy with your borrowed money might increase in value.
Yes, or fall in value. The property market is naturally leveraged, and then the moment the market falls, you get this painful thing called negative equity, which is just another way of saying that leverage has come back to bite you. If you imagine what the world would be like if nobody could get a mortgage. You can just look back 50 years. It was very difficult for anybody who wasn't very well established to get a mortgage. Most people had to rent. Houses were actually pretty cheap to buy, and so people would buy up houses, rent them out for a huge profit. So in many ways, the accessibility of mortgages, it's created a lot of risk in the housing market, but it has democratised the housing market as well.
More democratic. But without mortgages, houses would cost roughly what they cost to build, much as they do in Sunderland, for instance. Is that... Don't worry, they won't be listening. It's okay. It's, has a moral dimension, doesn't it? I think property ownership, and certainly people who buy property in order to invest, as it were. There is a disdain for it. It certainly, I think, it has a political dimension. It's something to do possibly with the morally dubious way most people first got hold of property. There's an old saying on the left from a French anarchist called Proudhon, who said property is theft, by which he meant that the initial stake in any property must have been seized without any kind of commercial transaction having taken place. I'm not just talking about Foxtons. I'm talking, for instance, a bit further back to even marginally aggressively less acquisitive people such as the Spanish conquistadors who wiped out the Incas. But for most of prehistory, for most of ancient history, land was held in common. God did not apportion any of it out to named individuals and tribes, despite what Zionists and Yorkshiremen would have you believe. So it follows that ownership therefore began when land was at some point arbitrarily seized, such as during the colonization of the New World. When Europeans arrived in America, they found an indigenous people living on it, and these Native Americans had been living on the land for centuries, but they'd never really discovered it. And initially, the Native Americans were skeptical about the whole concept of land ownership. Even today, it is fair to say they have their reservations. So I'm allowed one of those per series, OK? I'd like to talk now to somebody who knows a little bit more about this than even me or Tim put together. He's written a book called Who Owns Britain? Please welcome to the stage Kevin Kyle. Hello, Kevin. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming along to join us. Can I ask you initially, I mean, the obvious question to begin with is the one suggested by your own book, who does own Britain?
Mrs. Windsor and her son Charles.
Right. That's not Barbara you're talking about. OK, that's...
There goes your MBE.
I mean, that's almost like a childlike view of the country, isn't it? That the Queen actually owns Britain. But you would say that's legally the case.
It's legally the case. The whole system in the country is based on the fact that she owns the land. You own the bricks, perhaps, but the Crown owns all land. And the Crown and Prince Charles, sorry, I want to be accurate here.
Well, and what does Prince Charles own?
He owns Cornwall.
And that's where he makes his biscuits?
Something like that.
Okay. But the Queen owns all the rest. Where does that title come from, then? Is that from time immemorial?
No, William the Conqueror, alias William the Bastard. That's what the French call him, and he was one of theirs.
Oh, right.
We really got the short end of the stick when he turned up here.
So he established ownership of the country?
Yeah, he enforced it.
And is this to do with the Doomsday Book?
No, that was his tax list.
Okay.
And it was mostly the big landowners. But no, there was a prior history of the Crown owning land. The Roman emperors claimed to own all land, so there was a precedent
before
he got here.
Now, a lot of people will hear this and will think, well, it's all very well and good, but it's a kind of an academic distinction. We all know that we buy and sell our houses without the Queen getting involved. It would crop up in the papers if she ever put her oar in. Does it actually have an impact in some low rumbling frequency that we're not aware of, but that is actually distorting the land market in the UK?
No. It's only an emergency that it becomes clear. During the last war, the Ministry of Defence occupied 11 million acres of Britain. That's a sixth of the two islands. And they didn't pay rent because they did it for the Crown who owned the land.
Right. And the people who had previously been occupying that land were just shunted to one side.
They were given dilapidation and they were given new fences and things like that, but they weren't paid rent.
So another big question, is land scarce in the United Kingdom? You know, one side of the political divide will certainly say things like, we're full, and the other side will say no.
No, land isn't scarce in the United Kingdom. All of us live on less than 10% of the two islands.
Less than 10% of the land is covered.
Is occupied by bricks and mortar and people.
That's extraordinary.
That's 90% isn't.
That 90% is just fields and mountains and rivers and lakes and whatever.
Fly over it. Yeah. It's full of fields and cows and things.
So, putting aside the necessity of farming some of it, you know, in order to provide food, are you saying it is unnaturally distorted in that respect? Are we maintaining the countryside out of some sentimental attachment to that ratio?
No, the people who argue for protecting the countryside are mostly landowners who are protecting their interest in high land prices.
Is there any prospect of that being overturned or changed?
Well, the simple prospect is inform the public. Tell people how much land there actually is and tell them not to listen to these people who say, you know, 35 years from now, England will be covered with bricks and mortar.
Are we not, though, quite a densely populated country by European standards, aren't we?
No, the places we live in are densely populated, but there's an enormous amount of empty space out there. A very high percentage of farmland is not properly used at all. A lot of people get money for not putting cows in the fields and not growing anything in them. The whole system is crazy.
Do you invest in land yourself, or do you take purely an academic interest?
Not formally. We have our house so we can live in it.
But just...
I know that sounds bizarre, but the investment I'd advise is your own home.
Thank you very much. Kevin Cahill, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I'm aware that this segment might have turned a lot of you into anarchists and lost you from Radio 4 listening figures forever. If that's the case, I'll bid you farewell and only ask that you don't upturn too many bins near my house as it plays havoc with the seagulls. But for the rest of the heartless robots still with me who see the potential of riding a leveraged screwdriver to untold riches, it's time to get down to the nitty-gritty of property speculation. Before we do, there is one golden rule I've learned the hard way. Do bear in mind that owning your own home is the only example of investment which you yourself can royally balls up with your stupid DIY improvements. If you buy shares in a company, it's very unlikely they'll give you a go at running it for a week and come back to find you've broken all the oil rigs or flooded Canary Wharf trying to turn it into a wet room. So it may be best to separate your house from your investment. To that end, apart from residential properties, as we've discussed, there are two main other ways in. Commercial property, which is best if you want to drive around it on a forklift truck, or farmland, which is great if your main objective is to shout at people to get off it. What do we need to remember when getting our investment hands dirty? Let's ask Tim. Apparently, farmland has increased in value on average by 20% every year for the last decade, which is an extraordinarily good return. And yet, actually getting income from farms has fallen. Is there some hidden angle? Is there some racket going on with farming?
I don't think there's a racket, but I mean, there are tax breaks. People see something increasing in value. The newspapers start writing about it, and you say, oh, maybe I should invest in a farmland fund, maybe I should buy a farm and stuff.
Are you saying it's a bubble?
It looks like speculation. No one ever knows. But yeah, it's a bit weird that you can't make any money owning a farm, and yet people are willing to pay more and more for farms. Yeah. And it's not as if they're suddenly handing out planning permission freely. Economists call this financialization, really, the way the economy has been taken over more by financial services and by banking. And so more and more people are investing in things that they don't really know what it is.
Yeah.
We're basically getting involved where we have no idea what we're doing.
Yeah, it's all become quite abstract. Buy-to-let. Let's have a look at buy-to-let. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me the key here is not to buy anything that anyone in their right mind would want to own. If you buy something that anyone else would want to live in, you'll be up against people who do want to own it, and then the price will go up. Whereas what you want is something that people would only consider living in if they can convince themselves that they're just going through an unfortunate phase, possibly transitional, and therefore they're renting. And then you're only likely to be competing against other profiteering lizards like yourself. Buy-to-let is fairly straightforward. It seems so, at least. But are there hidden snags? Merrin.
It's definitely not as much of a cert now today as it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, because we've just come out of a 30-year cycle of falling interest rates. And interest rates have now fallen to really the lowest they can possibly go. They're at their lowest in 300 years. The only way from here is up. And house prices tend to move inversely to interest rates.
Because the price of a house is really the price of the mortgage that you will...
Exactly. Demand for housing is all about the price of credit.
So the idea that bricks and mortar is just bricks and mortar is a delusion.
The reason why everyone loves buy-to-let is because they feel they know where they are with bricks and mortar. You know, they can touch it, they can feel it, they can see it. Mm. They think they understand it. But of course, the really interesting thing is that you don't really understand bricks and mortar unless you understand global interest rates. You know, if you can predict where interest rates in the UK are going to go over the next 10 years, then sure, you understand bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
If you can't, and I certainly can't, I'm pretty sure, just a guess, Simon, but I'm guessing you can't either, then you don't understand bricks and mortar.
And yet you kid yourself you do, because you think, you know, it's all just about whether that front door needs a new lick of paint or
exactly.
not.
Exactly.
So, as long as we're talking about potential pitfalls, it's probably time to talk about the elephant in the room, the thing which seems to scare most people when it comes to investing, and that is the bubble. Spotting housing bubbles before they pop is one of the great mythical skills. It's up there with alchemy and prophecy and getting your printer to successfully scan and print a document. So, Tim, do you have any tips?
I mean, there are a couple of ways of thinking about bubbles. A bubble is when any asset price gets divorced from the fundamental value. A property is delivering you rental returns. A bond or a share is paying dividends or paying interest. Now, if the price of that asset is nothing to do with the financial returns that you're receiving, and the only reason to buy that asset is because you think it's going to keep going up in price even more, that's a fairly good working definition of a bubble. Now, there is another definition which was put about by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller. He said you need to think of it more as a psychiatric disorder. Is everybody talking about rising prices? Do people tell themselves that this time is different? Do you have this conversation everywhere you go? And if you can tick a few things off on your psychiatric checklist, then, yeah, it's a bubble.
There's a very famous story about the stock market. They didn't use the word bubble, of course, but in 1929, a wealthy investor sat down one day on Wall Street to get his shoe shined, and the shoe shine boy started giving him stock tips. And he suddenly, a little light bulb went on over his head, and he thought to himself, when the shoe shine boy is getting involved in the stock market, that means everyone's in, it's reached the pit of hysteria. There's no new money to enter this market, it's reached its peak, and he walked in apparently and sold everything and escaped scot-free about 2 weeks before the crash came. And that story is most often told, funnily enough, about Joseph Kennedy, who was John F. Kennedy's father. So it just goes to show, you know, you don't use all your luck up in one go, but... It's also a question of scale. You could argue that the entire Earth, viewed from an adequate distance and over an adequate timescale, is just one big housing bubble. Things go and rise and fall all the time. I think the word bubble is deceptive. I think of them as being a bit more like waves that terrify a novice surfer but stiffen an export board shorts with excitement. They lift you up to heights that the laws of nature suggest you shouldn't be able to reach. They propel you forward with a momentum that is exhilarating. And if you're lucky enough to be borne along on one and get off at the right moment, it's utterly exciting. It's all you can talk about afterwards, which is why surfers have their own bars near beaches and people in Wandsworth have their own bars where they can talk about house prices. I think it's a mistake to be completely pessimistic about the future of the bubble. All best things happen in a bubble. What is falling in love but a bubble? A period of unfettered optimism where grand, unrealistic plans are laid that eventually, yes, collapse under the weight of despair into great loss. Clinton still haven't got back to me about that as a Valentine's card message, but... What have we learned this evening? Well, the best way to get your hands on some land is to get some leverage, then use it to buy a Russian tank and annex whatever takes your fancy. Sell your house and invest it all in obsidian. But seriously, run for your lives. Do not get involved in land at any level whatsoever. It's utterly unpredictable. Interest rates will go up. Values will plummet. You will be utterly ruined. But in the long term, you should be fine. Thank you very much for listening. I've been Simon Evans. Thank you and good night. You've been listening to Simon Evans Goes to Market, where I, Simon Evans, was joined by Tim Harford, Merrin Somerset Webb and Kevin Carhill. It was written by me, Simon Evans, with Benjamin Partridge, Guy Venables and Andy Walton. And the producer is Talusha Galani.